Hi, I'm Lori Feathers, a bookstore owner and writer in Dallas, Texas.
And I'm Sam Jordison, a publisher from Norwich in the UK. And this is Across the Pond,
a podcast for readers of fiction eager to discover the most discussed and anticipated books on both sides of the Atlantic.
All right, let's dive in.
Hello, Sam.
Hey, Lori, how are you doing?
Doing really well. How about you?
I'm all right, thank you. It's getting cold here in the UK.
Is it? Yeah, it's colder here in Dallas, too. We're recording this on the day after Thanksgiving, and so kind of still in the Thanksgiving food and wine coma, but hopefully I'll get out of it soon because today is the biggest shopping day of the year in the United States, so the bookstore is going to be hopping later today.
Okay, great. And I've missed the chance to say happy Thanksgiving. Happy belated Thanksgiving, even more belated to our listeners who will be hearing this a few days after we record, but happy
Thank
shopping,
you.
I guess.
Thank you. It was a good one. It was a good one. Today, we're going to talk about a short story.
Yeah. So you sent this short story to me, and it is very short. Shall I intro it? It's Once by Grace Paley. And I'm embarrassed to say I've never read this. I've never read her. I've since read around it, and I've discovered that this is one of the most anthologized stories out there, and that Grace Paley's a very famous and well-regarded writer. So shows how much I know.
Yeah, Grace Paley was an American short story writer. She wrote quite a few short stories and was pretty popular in her day and still is popular. I have to say that I was introduced to this story through Lydia Davis's essay collection. She's got a short essay on, I think it's just called something like Five Short Stories I Love or something like this. And she mentioned this one, and she mentions the fact that it's 2 pages in length. So of course, when I saw that, I had to go right to it. And that's why I recommend that we read it and talk about it today. So where do you think we should start?
Well, maybe we should start by stopping, because it is 2 pages in length and it's widely available on the internet. It's been put up on a site called Biblioclept. So anyone that wants to read it before we dig into it, you can do it pretty quickly. So Once by Grace Paley, and you can disappear now, but come back quickly. And then we'll dig in and we'll explain for those of you who probably, as I wouldn't, haven't gone off to read it, what it's about as well. In fact, I might hand that over to you, Lori, because it's about 800 words long, but there's an awful lot in there.
Yeah. So it starts with a middle-aged woman sitting on the steps of a library. And we believe that she's come to the library to return 2 Edith Wharton novels that she has had at her house for 18 years.
And who would want to return an Edith Wharton novel? That's a really nice detail. Like, if you're going to keep something, let it be the House of Mirth.
Right. And so when she's sitting at the library steps, she sees her ex-husband, to whom she was married for 27 years. And we learn that she's currently, again, remarried, but we don't hear much about that marriage. But she says hi to her husband, and in a way that immediately kind of he finds objectionable. I think she says something like, "Hello, my life." And he's like, "What life? No life of mine." And then they start talking and he follows her into the library. And the librarian tells her that she owes $32 in overdue fees for the 2 books that she's held for 18 years. And she writes a check for $32 and hands it over to the librarian. And I guess I should go on. It is so short. I mean, it doesn't make sense to do a spoiler alert. But in the course of this library interaction, she and her husband are talking. And I think that the title of the story, Once, comes from the fact that, you know, the husband's kind of saying that there's all of these things that he's wanted, and including a boat, and he's now finally going to get a boat. But then he throws this accusation to her that you've never wanted anything, which is quite a loaded thing to say. And I think that our protagonist's reaction to that is a little bit interesting.
Yeah. Okay. So what does she want?
Well, I think she says or thinks that she wants to be a different person, a more effective person, the type of person that would not accrue $32 in overdue fines at the library.
Yeah. So I suppose we might as well end the story. It ends with her returning the books. So on one level, we can assume she has matured into this other person. But of course, it's all more complicated. And there's a lot of this story that is elusive. And, you know, there are very quick blink and you'll miss them references to other things that are going on, other things that she wants, in fact. So one of them is or was the end of the Vietnam War, for instance, which she talks about and which she says she didn't get for her children, in fact. And the story ends with this lovely image of her looking at, I think it's sycamore trees coming into fruition that, you know, they've been planted years before, and she looks out and sees that they've matured and have reached, she says, in fact, come to the prime of their lives. And that helps her decide to take the books back to the library. And that's quite an optimistic image, but is throughout this story this real sense of regret and of things not achieved. I mean, her marriage, for instance, seems to be a big source of regret. And partly because this guy she meets is such a dick. It's so horrible to her.
But. Yeah, she makes a comment early on that she's never been good regarding passage of time or realizing time passing. And we think that she's talking about the library books, but then her husband, accuses her of never having the Bertrams over for dinner. And her response to that is quite curious and kind of highlights this inability to kind of recognize the passage of time, because she says something like, well, if you'll recall, my father was sick that Friday, and then the children had things to do, and then the war happened. And then, you know, like all of these things that would have taken years and years. And she concludes, but yes, you're right. We should have had them to dinner. So that's kind of a little bit of a humorous part of the story.
Yeah, but on a technical level, all kinds of really interesting things are happening with time. So there's the 18 years that she hasn't returned the book. There's the 27 years of the marriage that have passed. And then there's this strange thing that you talk about that happens that, you know, they didn't invite the Bertrams to dinner. That seems like one specific thing. It starts off, something was happening that Friday, but then suddenly everything compresses and years are passing, you realize. And that kind of thing keeps happening throughout the story. And it's a really interesting effect. And I think partly that's where I get this sense of regret, almost this sense of years just kind of falling through your hands like sand. It's quite evocative and very impressive to get that much time and different variations of time into such a short space.
Yeah. I mean, you read a lot of short stories for your short story competition. And I don't know, do you have a lot of submissions that are maybe not quite this short, but are shorter, like kind of almost, I've heard people call this story flash fiction rather than a short story. And I'm not quite sure I really understand the difference.
No. Come on, let's get on to this. I mean, this is a digression, but yeah. I mean, flash fiction, I suppose it's a useful term, especially for people who are putting things up on the internet, and they can say it's flash fiction and it's a thing, it's a very discrete thing that is here and gone very quickly. And it works, you can read it in a page, but you know, where do the boundaries lie? I don't know. And it almost, flash fiction feels like a term that came along a lot later to describe a kind of story that has been around forever, you know, like In Our Time by Ernest Hemingway. There are some very short stories in there, and then there are these even smaller kind of 1-2 paragraph bits in between the stories, and nowadays people would want to call them flash fiction, but of course he didn't think of it in those terms at all.
Yeah.
So it's just a thing. It's a way of describing, it just means a very short story, doesn't it? I think, although if the, I'm now imagining flash fiction authors getting furious with me, and, you know, there is something unique and different that I'm missing, and I'm very sorry. And I wait to be educated on that.
So, Sam, I feel like this is a very effective short story, and there's a lot of pathos to it. Like I said, a little bit of humor. I'm not quite sure how she pulls it off. Maybe you think about it a little more structurally than I would.
I don't know. I don't know if I've got anything more to say about the structure, except it does come to that nice point with the trees and this final stable image after all this, you know, almost concertinaing time and everything being kind of expanding and contracting in strange ways. And it's, yeah, it's short and sharp and funny. I have a confession that when you sent it to me, my initial reaction was that I wasn't entirely certain about it. The first few lines and the way it breaks into dialogue, it's very confusing. And it took me a while to realize, deliberately so. And I thought, oh, well, this is a great excuse for me to go on a rant I've been wanting to have for a while about the fact that fewer and fewer authors seem to be using speech marks and quotation marks and setting out their dialogue properly, and how annoying it is when you get lost in that way, and why on earth they do it when there's no good reason for it. But actually, in this story, there really is a good set of reasons, I think, because it becomes blurry which bits are dialogue and which bits aren't. I mean, you can work it out, but you have to stop and look at it. And sometimes there are bits of speech that could be dialogue or might not, in fact, be. So, in fact, let's have a quick example. Right at the start, he goes, "He said, comma, no speech mark, what? What life? No life of mine." So that's clearly dialogue. Next line, "I said, okay, I don't argue when there's real disagreement. I got up and went into the library to see how much I owed them." Now, there's no speech marks anywhere in there, and it's hard to be certain which bits she's saying and which bits she's kind of thinking, or which bits she is telling we readers. But that blurriness, it adds to the overall effect of the story, I think, and that same sense of things being slippery and uncertain that you get from the concertinaing time effect. So it all adds up quite neatly and nicely. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah, it is. It is really impressive. And it's one of those stories that it's only going to take you 4 or 5 minutes to read it, but it almost asks you or beseeches you to read it again. And you certainly think about it a lot longer than 4 or 5 minutes that it takes to read it, I think.
Yeah, that's true. And I'm very conscious that I advised listeners that they might want to go off and read the story and be able to do it quickly. But I've become aware through having this conversation and thinking back over how I read the story that I actually had to read it 3 or 4 times to think I'd got on top of it. So perhaps that was a bum steer, in which case, forgive me. But, you know, go back and read it again and you'll get something out of it. And hopefully our conversation will help inform that reading.
Yes. And it certainly has made me want to read more Grace Paley, for sure. Because if this is indicative of how she works her art, I think it's pretty good. And I want to read more of it.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I'd never heard of her. And I feel like I want to hear a lot more now. So that's great. Thank you, Laurie.
Awesome. All right, Sam, it was good talking to you.
You too.
Welcome Across the Pond, listeners. We're very happy to have with us today novelist Christine Lai, who's here to discuss her debut novel, Landscapes. Landscapes is published by $2 Radio, and it is that publisher's submission for the 2023 Republic of Consciousness Prize for the U.S. and Canada. Welcome, Christine.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're really happy to have you today. I've been excited about this book for a long time. It was a real treat to finally have it in my hands and be able to read it. I love books that deal with art and topics around paintings and things. So this was definitely in my wheelhouse.
I'm glad to hear that.
Would you like to start with a short passage that maybe you can read for us?
Sure. I'll just start at the beginning of chapter one and just a bit of context. The book is divided into 3 parts. And the first part takes the form of a diary written by the protagonist, Penelope. So that's the part I'll be reading from. 1st of September. I picture myself standing in the midst of a ruin. All around me, there are mildewed canvases, rolled up crudely or crammed into drawers. The edges of the papers, mouse-eaten or worm-eaten, fall into heaps of dust. As I work through the disorderly archive and chip away at the mountain of responsibilities, my mind is drawn back to this image of Turner's studio, left in a state of Pompeii-like destruction after the painter's death. That same atmosphere of decay permeates the library in which I spend my mornings. On better days, disorder is forestalled, and there's only the linearity of the catalog and the neat collection of books and objects. On days of anxiety, such as today, I find myself stranded in the wreckage. The dust that has gathered in the corners, the moldy papers, the shelves that bend under the weight of books and archival boxes, all these seem to be advancing toward me, millimeter by millimeter, until they overwhelm me. 2nd of September. A calmer start to the day. A thin column of sunlight shines down from above. Elsewhere, the library's underground storage space is illumined by a solar power lamp that is recharged daily on the desiccated lawn. I write by the light of this lamp, and a pile of books serves as my desk. Before I sat down to write, I spent some time admiring the flowers I keep in secret. The earthquake 5 years ago resulted in an irreparable crack down one wall of the library. The plants have forced their way through the fissure and have begun to sprout in the space where books were once stored. Even now, as aridness eats through the outside world, the weeds and flowers that have flourished in the aftermath of disaster are protected by the shadows and nourished by the water from the broken pipe. I have not told anyone about this pipe, as it will be fixed immediately, depriving the flowers of their sole source of water. This spot of green is the only place where I allow water to drip away unchecked. These flowers, the only luxury I permit myself to keep in these days of want and longing.
Hey, thank you. So that opening sets the scene really nicely and gives us a pretty strong idea of the world that the book is set in and that something has gone wrong there. And there's a lot that's unique about the way you set things out in this book. But I want to ask, first of all, about the more general setting and the way it fits into dystopian traditions and your touchstones for that.
So I began with the setting, actually. So I really wanted the ruinous, dilapidated country estate. And there was kind of several sources of inspiration for that. So I was really drawn to the dilapidated houses in the novels of W.G. Zabold. So there's Ivor Grove in Austerlitz, Somerleton Hall, Ditchingham Hall in The Rings of Saturn. And he talks about how the building of these great houses necessitated destruction. So, you know, the removal of villages, the destruction of the woodland and so on. So I was just really drawn to like the country house as a symbol. So that was kind of where the idea for the setting came from. And then I did, you know, more research, you know, about country houses in general. And there was this part in John Berger's Ways of Seeing where he talks about, I'm sure you know, the Thomas Gainsborough, Mr. and Mrs. Andrews, and he talks about how the landscape depicted in the background is a visible form of capital, just like the painting itself is. So I just found that really fascinating. And so I started reading about, you know, the collections of art in these great houses and the Turner that's mentioned in the prolog, his painting of Aaron Breistein. So that was sold in, I think, 2017 for something like £18 million. And I remember reading these Sotheby's catalog. They listed on, you know, the provenance of the painting, all of these great houses in which the painting was once displayed. So that kind of led me to this link between the country house and art and issues to do with property and ownership. You know, I didn't want to have a kind of glamorous image of the country estate in the manner of like Downton Abbey or something like that. So I actually wanted to push back against that image. So the ruination was necessary. And I did want to include some details about the kind of colonial connections that some of these houses have. So there's a brief reference to the sugar wealth, and that's all based on my readings about these houses, which I found really illuminating. And I didn't actually know a lot about that colonial link. So yeah, it was just really eye-opening to me because I've been to some of these houses and, you know, they're now hotels or spas, and it's very easy to just, I guess, enjoy the beauty of these places and to overlook the history underneath and what the architecture might imply. Yeah, and so that's kind of where I got the idea of the house. As for the dystopian setting, I didn't set out to write a work of eco-fiction, I guess it's what it could be called. So in the beginning, it was just the house and the woman in the house. But during the writing process, so over the past 6 to 7 years, I think it became impossible to ignore what was happening in the outside world. And around the time when I started writing was also the time when I started seeing the word Anthropocene more frequently in the press and in various articles. So I wanted to bring that in just because that was kind of what I was witnessing and experiencing. And I think witnessing all of these events also meant it became difficult not to imagine what the potential consequences might be. So it was a kind of process of like extrapolation and thinking about, you know, what's going to happen over the next couple of decades, as it were. And like, for example, you know, I was just reading recently that by the 2030s, we might witness the first summer without Arctic sea ice. And that's just mind-boggling to me. And all of these like climate deadlines, I found, you know, just extremely anxiety inducing and heartbreaking. And thinking about just how soon a lot of these events will occur also gave me like a sense of dissonance in terms of time, in terms of how we experience time, how everything kind of speeds up, as it were. You know, it takes hundreds of years to grow a forest, but minutes to burn it all down. So I wanted to play with the concept of time in some ways in the book. So there's no specific year that's named, and, you know, it's non-linear. So there's this kind of mixing of past, present, and future. And so that was kind of my attempt to think through how to inhabit in this time of drastic change and crises.
Yeah. Right. So you were much more inspired, in fact, and maybe terrifyingly, by reality than by science fiction and the wider science fiction tradition, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And the bits about the tree disease, so someone asked me about that and they thought it was speculative, but that's actually not. So the information about the trees, that was actually from the website of the National Trust and the Woodland Trust. And I did read some scientific articles about tree disease that are threatening trees all throughout the world. So that's quite terrifying to read that it's actually happening already and has been happening for a few decades now. Yeah.
Speaking of bringing the real world into the book, the narrator, Penelope or Penny, she comes to Mornington Hall a few years ago from the time that she's writing the diary to be an archivist. Mm-hmm. But she's not living alone in this crumbling gothic type of mansion. You also have immigrants that mm-hmm. are, I guess, seeking refuge, mm-hmm. living at the hall for a period of time and then moving on. Do you want to talk about what inspired you to kind of bring the immigration and the immigrant story and kind of how you imagined ecological devastation impacting the immigrant situation?
Yeah, so the inclusion of the immigrants and the refugees, that's also inspired by my research, you know, about what's happening right now. And, you know, there are all these projections about how there will be more and more climate refugees over the next couple of decades, and there will be a real crisis in terms of people finding homes. And so I think this idea of precarity, of instability, is just something that we're already witnessing. And I wanted Penelope to be someone who has her gaze turned outward toward others, toward the outside world. And I read, you know, people like John Berger and Simone Weil. So then she ends up reading those books, and that was kind of meant to be a direct reference to what had inspired me to include these elements in the book. I guess, you know, initially I read a lot about trauma, about people who, you know, memoirs and people have written in the aftermath of violence of different kinds. And so that was certainly an important part of her character. But I also wanted her to kind of not be confined to that, not to be labeled a victim, as it were. So the inclusion of all of these other characters, I think, kind of helped balance out certain aspects of her character. And I wanted to explore this idea of home, of what it means to build a home and to maintain it. So this crumbling estate is meant to be her home, but yet it is not something that's exclusive to her or to her family. It is actually meant to be shared. And they also take some of the parts of the park that were once public commons and they revert it back into public property that people share. I was trying to think of, you know, a vision of the future that had a glimmer of hope. Yeah, this in this idea of community, of offering refuge to others.
Sorry to move it from hope back to trauma, but I think there's an important plot point that maybe you could explain to our listeners.
Oh, yes, the trauma. So the readers find out early on, I think by like page 10, that Penelope had been sexually assaulted by a man with whom she was in relationship with about 20 years prior to the writing of this diary. So that's kind of the main, I guess, conflict in the book. And so as she is sorting through the books and artworks in the house's collection, she is also reflecting on her past and trying to reconcile herself to what had happened. And in between the chapters, there are these art fragments about art history, or specifically representation of sexual violence in Western art. And so these essays are meant to be written by Penelope, which readers find out about towards the end of the book. So the essays were written 20 years before, when she was trying to deal with what had happened to her, and because she has a background in art history. So the art is a lens through which she is trying to understand her own experiences.
And she kind of stays in this setting at Mornington Hall, where there are all of these memories and where the trauma is relived almost daily, because Mornington Hall is owned by a family, and it was one of the brothers of the current owner that assaulted her, raped her. So I guess I wanted to ask, maybe in kind of keeping her in that space, she goes away for a while, but then she ultimately comes back, and having her have a romantic and loving relationship with the brother of the man that assaulted her. How did you decide to play that? That's a kind of a sensitive area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think I really wanted to kind of portray this process of reclaiming certain spaces. So she goes to, you know, the Tate Britain, for example, where she had been with Julian, the man who had assaulted her, in order to reclaim the space. And that return to the gallery was what started her process of writing about the artworks, and what started her, I suppose, process of healing. So I didn't want her to be someone who, you know, was letting go of all of these parts of her past that were these places that played an important role in her life because of what had happened to her. So I think the return to these spaces, to the house, was important in terms of, I guess, her psychological development, if that makes sense. Yeah.
And this guy, Julian, he is very different to most of the characters in the book in that he doesn't have to endure that precarity you were talking about. He's rich and has a very different existence. So can you tell us a bit about that and how it operates?
Yeah, so I wanted to explore the idea of like class divide, of the problem of wealth. And that is related to the country house as a setting and as a symbol of power and exclusivity. So for me, Julian embodies a particular way of relating to the world. And throughout the book, he is kind of mostly seen in contained spaces. Like he's mostly on a train inside his kind of first class car, or he's in a hotel room, he's in an art gallery. So he's always in these contained spaces. But when he is outside on the street, for example, when he is, you know, in the streets of Paris, he's often filled with a sense of insecurity and paranoia. So I wanted to portray this, I guess, tendency for the wealthy to enclose themselves and to shield themselves, shelter themselves away from disaster. And that's something we've already seen in the pandemic, that kind of that sheltering. So there are all of these spaces of, you know, containment, such as these domes. And so those are also symbolically related to Julian, to that kind of psychological evasion, as it were, and the need to kind of shelter oneself and to not be a part of the wider world, to not be a part of the community. Yeah, for me, these spaces of containment are kind of the opposite of the dilapidated house, which is a porous space that's kind of open to the outside world. The rain and, you know, the birdsong enters the house, and Penelope is always kind of looking outside, whereas he does the exact opposite. So I wanted them to contrast one another in multiple ways.
And it's not just paranoia with Julian, is it, that makes him separate himself off? So there's a passage where he's moving through the lower class compartments of a train and gets back to his first class carriage. And, you know, he's clearly upset by being among all the crowds of people who can't afford the kind of existence he has. But also once he gets onto the other side, that he's visible through the glass still, and he makes a very clear demonstration of sanitizing his hands in front of them and washing them off. So can you tell us a bit about that and how separation almost becomes a status symbol?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that the world inside these kind of the first class compartments, inside these domes, it's a kind of sanitized, idealized world that doesn't, you know, that seems to remain in the past. I guess the past, which would be our time now, and that doesn't seem to kind of respond to what is happening in the real world outside. And I think that Julian embodies that resistance to change, but also, I suppose, a sense of disgust toward others that's linked to his inability to empathize with others. And it's interesting. So a lot of readers have told me that they found him to be evil, and that, you know, people can't possibly be like this, to be so heartless and to be so cruel towards others. And I found that comment surprising, because I have met people who are like Julian. I'm not someone I know well, but, you know, I've certainly met people through work. I actually found that kind of way of relating to the world fascinating in a perverse way, maybe. And I was interested in the psychology of someone who is like that, who seems to move through the world almost like inside this glass case. You know, you can see them, but they're not ever kind of truly connected. And I found that really quite fascinating. So I don't think of it as psychopathy. You know, I think of it as, you know, a particular way of moving through the world, a particular way of protecting oneself and keeping this version of the world as always clean, that's always like free of clutter and free of problems.
This idea of space, I think, is really fascinating when you reflect on the principal or one of the principal plot points in the book. Aiden, Julian's brother, who's now in a romantic relationship with Penny, he's decided to sell Mornington Hall. And that's part of the reason why Penny is archiving furiously and frantically, you know, all of the art items at the estate. And Aiden feels duty bound, I guess, to contact Julian, who he's estranged from, and say, hey, we're selling. And if you want to come back one last time, you know, you better get back here now. So there's this tension, you know, Julian's on a train, he's coming back to Mornington Hall. Penny is fearful of his reappearance in her life, and she's having nightmares and she's traumatized. And so the hall is an open space, and there's this tension about Julian invading the space and really disrupting the relationship between Penny and Aiden. Do you want to talk about how you kind of kept that tension flowing throughout the novel?
Yeah, so I guess the narrative seems to kind of build up to their reunion, as it were. So him coming back to the house. And so throughout her diary entries, which span from September to March of the following year, she is thinking about this imminent reunion and what that might mean for her. Because they hadn't seen each other for 22 years. So I guess from her perspective, you know, she's kind of moved on. The space is now hers. You know, she's hosted artist residencies and she offers refuge to climate refugees. So the space is very much transformed from what it was 22 years ago. And yeah, so there's that sense of her not only losing what the self that she had built over the past two decades, but also the house itself. And not just through the demolition, but also through his return and all the things that he is associated with, you know. Yeah, I don't know if that answers your question.
It does. I also wanted to ask you, you talked a little bit about the research that you did, you know, for the book in terms of climate issues, tree diseases. I wanted to ask about two other items. One is archival science, because I found the archive reports that Penny does and are interspersed throughout the narrative to be absolutely convincing in terms of how you describe the damage to some of the documents and the art, and also Turner's paintings. Tell us about the attraction that you have for those.
So the archive items, first, I'm really glad that you like the descriptions. Yeah, it was a really important part of the writing for me. So I actually read a lot of booksellers' descriptions of books. So I, you know, went on A-Books and there was like an antiquarian book fair. I found that language very interesting. The way that, you know, they describe like the foxing and the water damage. And yeah, I wanted to highlight the fragility of these physical objects, but also the fact that they've endured a lot and that they're still here and they still convey a message. And a lot of the books that are included in the archive were books that were sources of inspiration for me. So I wanted to include them in not just in the endnotes, but in the space of the novel itself. And as for Turner, I've loved Turner for a long time. He was part of my PhD, so I did a lot of research on him when I was in the UK. And yeah, I've just really drawn to his paintings. And sometimes it's hard to articulate why, you know, we're drawn to a work of art. And there are parts where Penelope struggles with the language, with the expression of that love for art, and that struggle is very much my own. But I think, you know, I was drawn to Turner partly because he lived in a time of great change. He lived to see the start of the Industrial Revolution, and a lot of his works engage with change. And I think I recounted somewhere in the novel that, you know, he would leave the windows to his studio open. So like the rain and the soot and the dust would just settle on his canvases. He didn't take great care of them, which is, you know, quite strange. There's also new evidence that suggests that the light, signature Turnerian light, that he painted was actually the effect of smog scattering sunlight. So he was actually recording these atmospheric changes that were happening at the time. So I think that his works show how, you know, the work of art is a kind of porous object that takes in the outside world, that reacts to what is happening in the outside, perhaps in the way that a book does. So I was just really drawn to that aspect of his work. And, you know, I think he was a very interesting person in his life. And like Penelope, he came from a working class background, but, you know, became very successful as an artist. So he frequented some of these country estates where his patrons lived. So I think he might have seen these spaces in a similar way that she does, you know, coming from a kind of similar background.
Coming back to this idea of loving art, at one point in the book, Penny worries that that is even naive from the point of view of scholarship, is the way she thinks about it. I wonder if you could tell us about that. These terrible scholars who have been telling you not to enjoy things.
Yeah, I guess, well, her skepticism about scholarship, I suppose, is my own. And that line was inspired by a line from Jenny Erpenbeck's Go, Went, Gone, which features an academic who's, you know, becomes very disillusioned about the work that he has done once he has seen what happens in the outside world. And that part of the book is related to Penelope's work with the climate refugees and her sense of, I guess, inadequacy. You know, what does it mean to look at art, write about art, write a book when so much is happening in the world? You know, what does art do? And yeah, what does a book do? And so those are questions I do ask myself. I don't think I have answers to those questions, but I think it's important to think about them. Yeah. And to think about, you know, what do we do with this when there's so much that is nightmarish in the world?
So the question I really want to ask now, although you already said you don't have an answer, is what does your book do? I mean, maybe tell us what writing it did for you, and, you know, if it gave you a kind of catharsis or helped you crystallize your ideas about some of these issues.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Writing definitely helped me personally. It was cathartic. And I think it also helped me think through some issues to do with, you know, what I was witnessing in the world and just what it means to live in this time, to put it broadly. And I did find that, you know, with creative forms of writing, there is this kind of like open-endedness and capaciousness that academic writing does not necessarily offer. So I really appreciated that about writing creatively. As to what writing does for the world, I don't know. I mean, I don't think a single book will ever make changes, but collectively, I believe in the project of literature. And I think that there is still hope in that sense of literature, just making these kind of minute changes, changing individual consciousness. There's this quote by James Baldwin I always love, and I'm paraphrasing. You might know this. What was it? You write knowing that literature will never change the world, but if you can just shift one single mind, you will somehow affect it change, something along those lines. So I think that that's true of books and, you know, all works of art. So I think collectively there is some hope there.
I'm going to try to ask an easier question than the one Sam just posed to you, Christine.
Just have to pause things quickly to say, you know, hear, hear, that was a great answer. So thank you. After
making you sweat that out. I loved some of the imagery in the book, and I thought that you did a really good job of letting the reader along with you imagine what a world of ecologically induced scarcity would be like. And one of my favorite images in the book is when Penny goes to a bookseller's stall into the town, and she knows the stall. She goes there a lot to look at the books that are all, you know, covered in plastic, and the bookseller doesn't just let anyone touch them, but they're very precious and very scarce. And she notes that the bookseller is typing on an old fashioned, at this point in age, typewriter, one of the manual typewriters. And she's wondering, where in the world is he procuring ink ribbon in these days for this typewriter? And she notes that he's typing away, but There's no ribbon in the typewriter. He's just wanting, I guess, to hear the resonance of the keys hitting the blank paper over and over again. And so I wanted to ask about how you imagined some of these things. I love that scene a lot.
Oh, I'm so glad. Yeah, I think some of those scenes just come from my own, you know, like nightmares of what I fear would happen in the future, that kind of scarcity, not having enough books, not having access to writing instruments. I think that it creates, that kind of scarcity would create like a void in culture, and voids are motifs that kind of recur throughout the book. And, you know, I think that in some ways, you know, it is hard to imagine what the world would be like without easy access to books and printed material and what that would mean for education, for literacy and so on. Yeah. And I think, you know, Penelope, in many ways, she's mourning all of these things that have been lost. So I see the book as a kind of, it's like a catalog of these losses. So it's not just the ecological losses, but also, you know, losses in terms of people's daily lives and the things that they might enjoy, like typewriters and reading and buying books and so on. Yeah.
I think you did a marvelous job in this book in terms of showing us the resilience of nature and the resilience of art, but also their fragility as well. And it's just a really interesting, I think, depiction of hopefully not where we're going as a society, but a really thoughtful and thought-provoking book. And I wanted to thank you, Christine Lai, for coming on the show and talking to us about it.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a great pleasure.
And I want to encourage all of our listeners to go out to your local independent bookstore and purchase a copy of Landscapes by Christine Lai. Thank you.